My grandfather tied up what I can do with it pretty tightly. I think he might have guessed how I was going to turn out. No trust fund preening capitalist, am I?
Archer looked around. Okay, but you don't have to live like this, either.
You're right, I don't. Which shows that I'm much weaker than I think, and the draw of all that money is far stronger.
You still a card-carrying member?
It doesn't matter if I am or not. If my history came out, I'd be ruined. They'd probably find a way to take all my money away. And Danny's career would be ruined, of course. They'd assume he was a communist, and he'd be blackballed. So many already have been.
I didn't think you cared all that much about his career.
Talk is cheap, and I'm the queen of it. Sure, I spoke ill of Danny with you, but it wasn't because of his work, really. Okay, he's no Frank Capra or Howard Hawks, but then who is? He did bust his ass to get out of poverty, something I never had to do, and then he had to bust his ass to make it in this town. Again, something I never had to do. I just came here and bought the penthouse. I actually admire my husband's work ethic, his hustle. What I don't admire is his cheating on me with every big-breasted skirt that comes within range of his pecker. Do you blame me?
Can't say that I do. And his gambling?
Yes, I had to take care of that, and I did. And he's now got a limit, and the casinos know anything over that limit is his problem, not mine. And Danny knows it too, so he's a good boy. He wants to make films and chase women, not end up in the ocean with fish for friends.
How did Lamb get her hooks into you? She drew a cigarette from a bowl on a table and let Archer light it for her.
Ellie was always smart, cunning, observant. I lied to you before. We did know each other. See, I was a political science major too, and our friendship deepened in the Agora Society. She made me believe that she thought as I did, that she cared about the things I cared about. We're very close. I liked her. Very much.
She stopped speaking, and her eyes suddenly filled with tears. Watching her closely, Archer said, "Were you more than just friends? I'm just asking because when we talked before, you seemed worried that she might have been killed." She fiercely brushed the tears away.
Ellie didn't love me, if that's what you want to know. She was using me, biding her time. She broke my heart because it turned out she fell in love with a man.
Do you know the man's name?
No.
Then what happened?
The years passed. I didn't even know she was in L.A. when I got here. But she obviously found out I was here, because one morning I got a special delivery letter.
What was in it?
Copies of certain documents with my signature on them. Pictures of me at events and with people who are on certain government lists now. And a letter addressed to me.
When did you know it was Lamb?
Oh, she made no attempt to hide her identity, Archer. The letter told me to meet at a certain place and time, and there she was. I don't know where she got all the stuff, but she had the goods on me, all right. She hadn't really changed. Other than her hair was black and straight. She was naturally blonde and curly in college.
So she made the blackmail pitch and you bid on it.
What else could I do? I had plenty of money.
And you weren't afraid she'd come back for more?
That was the thing with Ellie. With all her faults, when she told you she was going to do something, she did it. The reverse was also true. She told me that would be the only touch. And she never came back for more. And she returned all the original documents and the negatives of the photos.
And the times you dropped by her place in Malibu that you mentioned, other than the dinner with the Greens, it wasn't to take script notes, was it? Mars closed her eyes again, and Archer watched as her jaw trembled, but in a way that was probably jarring to her soul. The difference between feeling an earthquake tremor 100 miles away and being at the epicenter of an entire undulating city. She didn't look like a warrior now, he thought. She just looked human, like everybody else. She put a hand to her face, as if that would force the earthquake to stop. Eyes still closed, she said quietly,
I know it sounds crazy. I mean, the woman did blackmail me. But I hoped we might see each other again. She wasn't seeing anyone, or so I thought.
But that was a no-go?
There is apparently somebody else in her life now.
Do you know who?
No.
Archer thought he knew who that person was, but he wasn't going to tell Mars. The woman was hurting enough as it was. I heard she bought the house in Malibu because she had a friend there.
Who told you that?
Your husband. Right here on New Year's Eve. She regained her composure and blew out smoke.
I don't know anything about that, and I don't know why Danny would know.
Have you ever met Peter or Bernadette Bonham?
Never heard of them.
Okay. Where do you think Lamb is?
I don't know.
She looked at a wall and seemingly beyond it.
I hope she's okay. I've never wished her ill.
Most people would not wish their blackmailers well.
I'd like to think I can rise above such things, and I have a lot that I didn't deserve.
Despite your wealth, you didn't deserve to be blackmailed, so stop beating yourself up over it. Did you know Mallory Green owns a plane?
No, I believe Bart owns it.
I don't think so.
Does it matter?
Everything matters, Gloria. He rose. And thank you for your frankness. I know it was hard, but you've helped me a lot.
Do you think you can find Ellie?
I think I'm going to have to. She walked him to the door. I take it you won't be attending the McCarthy event tonight, he said.
On the contrary, I'll be right there in the front row with the biggest, fattest tomatoes I can find, and I have a hell of an arm.
Remember to take pictures. She reached up on tiptoe and kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you, Archer.
For what?
For being a nice guy. They're a lot rarer than you might think, as every woman out there can tell you.
As Archer walked out, he again envisioned Mars as a warrior, only this time armed with tomatoes instead of a sword, to do battle against the forces of evil. He thought Uncle Joe might truly meet his match tonight. Chapter 64. Today, under the sun, Bel Air was just as pretty as the less affluent parts of L.A., Archer thought. At least, on the outside. The inner core was a whole other sordid tale. He stopped in front of the Jacoby estate. The tall, skinny palm trees waved to him in the wind like flitting fingers. He knocked on the door, and the hinged butler statue answered after a bit of a wait. I'd like to see Mrs. Jacoby. I was here before. The studio said she was at home today when I phoned earlier. Who in the hell are you? Simon Jacoby was looking over the butler's aged shoulder. He had on dark tweed pants and a salmon-colored shirt under a white cotton sleeveless golf sweater. He seemed well hydrated and had a tumbler of what looked to be scotch in hand. Archer had another marker to test that hunch. The man reeked of it. He squinted at Archer.
Don't I know you, fella? You look familiar, and not in a good way.
Name's Archer. He showed the man his official ID. He thought maybe Jacoby had seen him at the casino while he'd been losing at kiddie poker. Jacoby's face flushed as his anger hit another level.
A private investigator? What the devil are you doing showing up at my...
I'll take care of it, Simon, said a voice. A moment later, Alice Jacoby appeared. Her hair was down, and she had on a colorful bandana. She wore a pair of jeans with a green sweater and low heels. Her cheeks were flushed, and she looked like she might have been crying. When she turned to the side, Archer saw a yellowish bruise on her cheek and a blackened mark around her eye. He glanced at her husband and felt his hand curl to a fist.
Who is he?
Demanded Simon.
What is he doing here? By God, if...
She put a calming hand on his arm.
He's trying to find Ellie Lamb. She's gone missing. I told you, dear. I spoke to him before. It's all right. It has nothing to do with us.
Damn right it doesn't, he sputtered.
glaring at Archer and finishing his drink.
Mr. Archer, this way, please.
Simon Jacoby shouted after Archer.
And a wife can't testify against her husband. You remember that, Mr. P.I.?
She led him quickly down the hall. Archer looked back once to see Simon Jacoby staring at the floor like he wasn't sure what he was actually standing on. She led him into a small study and closed the door, then turned and faced him. Archer eyed the room. It looked insubstantial, profoundly wanting after the grand space he had been in previously here. And Alice Jacoby looked smaller too, less significant, as though she had gone from the lead role to a bit player, diminishing the woman in every meaningful way. Did he do that? Asked Archer, pointing at her injured face. She subconsciously worried at it with her long fingers.
It was a misunderstanding.
No, it was a beating.
She shot him a dull-eyed glance, although it still carried gravitas.
That's how most men handle misunderstanding.
Then she pulled at her wedding band like it was a tumor she wanted to excise.
Is that what he meant when he said you couldn't testify against him? He's wrong. You can if you're the victim, if you're in danger.
Which I'm not. Not really. He'll be fine after he... after the drinks.
Archer didn't believe this, and she didn't seem to either. Archer took off his hat and twirled it between his fingers.
He's sticking to his Vegas betting limit?
He has to, doesn't he?
She said resignedly.
Nice to hear. Gloria Mars is a good friend of yours. But friends have their limits, and she has her own misunderstanding to deal with at home.
Yes, I know. There's an awful lot of misunderstanding in this town.
She motioned to one of the two chairs in the room.
Please, sit.
He did so, while she remained standing.
Do you need a drink?
He asked, staring at her. Jacoby wouldn't meet his eye.
I would very much love one. Which is why I'm not going to have one.
She glanced in the direction of the hall, where her drunken husband was probably still standing and wondering where he was.
A good friend of mine was shot last night, nearly killed.
Her face flushed as she looked down at him.
What?
A block over from the Jade. The truck with a dope shipment was heading there. They'd already dropped off the people they sell.
He stopped twirling his hat.
Is that selling people bit in Eleanor Lamb's script? And how do you design a set for something like that, I wonder? Do you just describe the interior of the truck? Or the shithole where they keep those poor souls before they get delivered straight to hell?
He had decided on the way over how he was going to play this.
Just blast it out like water from a fire hose.
But it was actually a subtler move than it looked to be. She first turned white, and then crimson, and then gray in her own little version of a bastardized rainbow. Now she sat. It seemed her legs could no longer support her full-figured body. She took out a pink Kleenex from her jeans pocket and dabbed at her eyes. Archer watched her.
Cecily Ransom was really bowled over by Lamb's script. I think she wants to direct it, so your wish of working with her might come true. By the way, how did you and Lamb get inside the Jade to do the research? Or did you just feed her what she needed? Because my witness was right. You have been to the Jade multiple times. Which means you lied to me.
Jacoby rubbed her thighs, her hands moving in jerky motions as though she had partially lost control of them.
See, my friend who almost died would like to know. And so would I. Because this is all tied to the Jade. And now so are you.
Does this have to be a police thing?
Asked Jacoby hopelessly.
I don't know. Does it?
She lifted her gaze to his. Her eyes promising depth, but there was really nothing in them that Archer could see, except stark fear. He could certainly understand that one.
Do you know where Lamb is?
She shook her head, her eyelids fluttering, like they had come loose from her face and were desperately trying to hang on.
Do you know why she disappeared?
Another shake of the head. The hands were now kneading the thighs with more vigor than was probably required, but Archer didn't stop her. He didn't care really what she was doing to herself. Willie Dash's almost dying had changed pretty much everything for him.
Your friend is a blackmailer, you know. She got her claws into Gloria Mars for all the money she needed to buy and fix up the Malibu place. Did you know about that?
Jacoby managed to say something, but her voice was too low. I'm sorry I didn't hear your answer.
I knew,
she said more boldly. What makes no sense to me is how somebody like you goes into a place like that and just, what, looks around? Darren Paley doesn't like people just looking around, but he is a guy who'll do pretty much anything for money. So did you pay him? Did you tell him you just wanted to experience Chinatown? I don't see why, since there's nothing really Chinese about it. Hell, you could have designed it on one of your little mock-up boards. But then again, he really doesn't strike me as a guy who would buy into that bullshit, no matter how much dough you flung at him. As Archer had been talking, his gaze had been wandering, until it reached a large tapestry hanging on the wall. He rose and walked over to it, studied the design, knowing that he had seen it before. On a bed at the Jade. He turned to her. What does that symbolize? Jacoby looked up at where he was pointing with the rim of his hat. She slowly rose and joined him.
It's the Chinese symbol for fire.
They have that in their damn baiju, that's for sure.
Fire, which in the Chinese culture can mean strength, persistence, vitality.
Just that?
No, it can also mean destructive behavior, as in fire burns everything to ash.
He looked at her, his face flushing, because he could feel the waves of revulsion slamming over him. Well, that fits the old Jade, doesn't it? He pointed accusingly at the tapestry. You didn't pay Paley so you could go to the Jade and snoop around. He paid you, Miss Set Designer, to decorate all the rooms there, didn't he? She turned and dropped back into her chair like all the blood had flowed right out of her, leaving empty veins and a useless heart. Archer said, they were all the same because they were designed by somebody who knows little about the actual subject, but put together something that looks authentic on the surface. Still no answer. She was kneading her thighs again. Part of Archer wanted to stop her, twist her arm, hear the woman cry out in pain. But he didn't. That would make him like her husband, and that was a line he would not cross. Tears slid down her face, making trenches in her makeup and causing her bruises to glisten. I mean, with this big house, big gambling bills, 3 adorable kids and a drunk of a hubby who's probably going to lose his job and slap you around even more, you probably needed a commission. Jacoby gripped the arms of her chair, having apparently reached her limit with Archer's taunts. She rose and exclaimed,
you have no idea how hard I've worked, how much I've had to sacrifice, what I've had to do to get where I am, to escape where I came from.
The voice, tone, and posture were all different now. It was like someone had heated a rock to such a stark temperature that all sorts of things were oozing out of it, and she wasn't yet finished oozing.
How dare you come here and insult me like this? Nothing was given to me. You know nothing about me and what I've had to do to make it here.
Archer did not retreat an inch. Sure I do. I hear it from everybody every day in this goddamn town. Everybody has their sob story. I was born on a stinking farm, or in a shack, or in your case, a holler, with nothing. Well, most people are born with pretty much nothing, and they never get to where you got to. They never live in a place like this, but they don't complain. They just live their lives. And my friend who almost died? He's got no sob story. He owns his mistakes. He doesn't make excuses. He taught me to do the same. And it comes in handy, because I tend to make mistakes. But not with you, I don't think. And you won't own up to them, lady, because you don't have the damn guts. Only in your mind is your life perfect, and you can't see it any other way.
I want you to leave. Right now.
And I want my friend to not be in the hospital with a bullet wound that nearly killed him. But sometimes we just can't have what we want. And one more thing. You obviously figured out what Paley was doing at the Jade with the dope and the slaves and fed it to Lamb, because it's in her script. So why do I think you never told Paley that this was also about you getting to set design a movie that was simpatico with Cecily Ransom's sensibilities? Because I'm not sure he'd be all that happy about it. And when that man gets unhappy, everybody gets unhappy. Trust me on that one. That thought ever crossed that little self-absorbed mind of yours?
Please, leave!
Did you find out what goes on in those pretty little rooms you decorated? Did you maybe have people there to spy for you? Take dirty little pictures? Do written reports for you? Like that little that-way honey gal with the leg tattoo they got there? She snoop around for you? Feed you stuff? If so, she'll be fish food if Paley ever finds out. Or maybe you don't care. It's just one little Chinese gal, after all. They got lots more of them. But you should care. Because Paley has a way of making people spill their guts before he kills them with a knife or a gun. And then he'll be coming to Bel Air, and you won't like it one little bit, and neither will your drunk punk of a husband, or your three innocent kids. Why don't you think about them, instead of just yourself for a change? She looked up at him with a miserable expression.
You don't understand anything.
I understand. You and Lamb want Samantha Lords to play the lead in your movie. I wonder why. Could it be you saw her there doing something she'd rather keep secret? Did you take pictures? Did you get parts of some of the filming they do in there? Could it be you and Lamb wanted to blackmail her into doing the role to give it star power?
You have no idea what—
I have every idea, lady. But let me tell you something. You have just as much of a chance of corralling Lords to be in your crummy movie as I do of marrying her, which means zero. She's got way too much class and brains to get mixed up with pathetic amateurs like you and Lamb.
What in the hell do you want from me?
Archer put on his hat. I'll have to think about it. And then I'll call you. And then you're going to do exactly what I tell you to. Or else, yeah, this becomes a police thing. He walked out of the room and down the hall. Not surprisingly, Simon Jacoby was still there looking at the floor. He glanced up at Archer.
What the hell are you still doing here?
I'm leaving.
Not fast enough, bub.
Jacoby swung a fist, but Archer easily caught it and twisted it behind the man's back. Then he jacked the doughy man face first against the wall, causing a framed painting of a stately horse in front of a stately manor to fall and crack. And if that wasn't poetic justice filled with a pound of irony. Archer drove the man's elbow so far up Jacoby's back, the man cried out in pain and belched up some of his scotch onto the fine wallpaper. Into his ear, Archer breathed, "Just give me a reason, pal, and you lay another hand on your wife. They won't find all the pieces to put you back together again. Scout's honor." He pushed a weepy Jacoby to the floor, stepped over him, and walked out the front door into the daylight. And he still felt like he was in the grip of hell. But it was just Bel Air. On a good day. Chapter 65. Archer called Ann Bender from a payphone and made arrangements to meet with her. He filled up the Oldsmobile's gas tank and drove straight to Anaheim. Bender looked the same as before, only older and sadder, as the reality of her husband's death no doubt weighed more heavily on the woman with each passing day. He had asked her on the phone about their bank records, but she said they had been in the safe. When he got to the house, he took a moment to check her husband's wheel decks again. He had an idea of what to look for, and he found the card. Just to be sure, he phoned the number on the card long distance. When someone picked up the call, Archer had his answer and set the phone down. Yep. Good people make bad decisions when things get tough. And Cedric Bender had. Because I just found out who had hired him. And it wasn't Mallory Green. He drove Bender to her local bank and arrived there just before it closed. She signed what she needed to sign and they made copies of the bank statements for her. Out of her earshot, Archer asked the branch manager about the foreclosure proceedings on the Bender's home. The man volunteered that Bender had paid the debt off in full. His widow owned the house free and clear. This had been about a month ago, he told Archer. Where did the money come from?
Mr. Bender told me that he had got some lucrative work and the payments were more than sufficient to pay off the mortgage.
He looked slyly at Archer.
And I have it on good authority that the company that owns the orange grove next to their house wants to expand. His widow will be sitting pretty if she sells.
Well, thank God for orange juice. And what would be a good price for the house and land, do you think? The man cleared his throat and fiddled with his tie knot.
Mrs. Bender has some decent acreage. If it were me, I wouldn't take a dime less than 10 grand.
Thanks. By the way, does the company that owns the Orange Grove bank with you? The man paled.
I can't divulge that information.
Archer leaned in with a smile. You just did, pal. Back in the car, Bender handed the file over to Archer.
Are you making progress?
She asked.
I am. And you might have more in your account than you probably think.
Why do you say that?
Just a hunch. I'll confirm it or not later. But if you do, maybe you can move away from the oranges. Bet you can get a pretty penny for your house and land.
You do? How much?
If anybody approaches you, don't take a dime less than 60 grand.
60,000? We only paid 1,200 for all of it.
Chalk it up to appreciation and living next to an orange grove. Not a penny less, okay?
All right.
Bender gazed out the window.
I never thought I would want to leave here, oranges or not. But now that Cedric's gone...
She said nothing else. She didn't have to. He dropped her off and returned to L.A. He'd forgotten that he hadn't eaten today, until his stomach started protesting in earnest. He ate at the Idle Hour on Vineland in North Hollywood. The place was in the shape of an enormous keg. So what else could Archer have with his meal other than a pint of their finest steam beer? He went over the bank statements and found that several large deposits had been made from checks drawn under the accounts of a company named PID. He looked at the copies of the checks the bank had kept. The signatures were so sloppy, he couldn't make them out. But coupled with the corresponding index card for PID he'd found in Bender's wheel decks, he had a pretty good idea of who had signed them. He put the file away and slipped into a phone booth to check his answering service. Earlier, Margaret Lamb had called back and said she would be in tonight. He checked his watch. It was well into the evening back in Washington now. He got change for a 5 from a waiter, slung in the quarters, and connected to the East Coast number with the help of the long-distance operator.
Hello?
Said a woman's voice. Mrs. Lamb?
Yes.
This is Archer. I left the message for you. I'm in Los Angeles.
Yes, Mr. Archer. Please tell me what is going on. Is Eleanor in some sort of trouble? I'm very worried. I've called her house, but there's been no answer.
Archer took a couple of minutes to fill in the woman. He didn't tell her about the dead body, only that Lamb had not been seen since New Year's Eve.
So there's been no word from her? After all this time?
No, but the police know about it and they are looking for her. I just don't know how hard.
Oh, this is all very distressing. She's my only child.
I can understand that. Look, can you tell me about your daughter? Anything that might help me locate her? I know she went to Wellesley.
Yes. She was a very good student. She graduated from there and came back and worked in Washington. My late husband, Charles, was in the diplomatic corps. Eleanor had lived all over as we moved for Charles's assignments. It was quite an adventure. He died of a heart attack 5 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that, she said sharply.
I hope this has nothing to do with that no-good husband of hers. I thought he was long out of the picture.
Her husband? I didn't know your daughter was married.
Tall and debonair and so cosmopolitan. Ironically enough, it was my husband who introduced them. You see, they were in the same profession, diplomacy. There were a lot of nice young men in the State Department, only he turned out to be not nice at all. A scoundrel, in fact.
She got married in D.C.?
No, they went to France for that. He insisted for some reason. Luckily, this was all before the war, so we were able to go.
What was her husband's name?
Nathaniel Summers.
Can you describe him, please? She did so. Archer asked her for more physical details and his age, and she provided them. He added on the intervening years and got a very clear picture of the man. So clear it was like a photograph. Why do you call him a scoundrel? What went wrong?
He was transferred to South America shortly after they were married. They had no children yet and none on the way, which I guess was a good thing, seeing as how it turned out.
What happened?
He traveled there alone to set up their household, start his assignment, and get things ready. Then he just vanished. Never called, never wrote. Charles made inquiries through the State Department. South America was not the safest place back then. The armies down there seem to keep overthrowing governments and shooting people. The State Department could find nothing out, and then washed their hands of it, if you can believe that. The official word was not to muddy the waters, to keep international relations smooth. Poppycock, I said. But Mr. Lamb's loyalties were with his precious department. Eleanor never gave up hope, though, and finally traveled down there about a year later. She was convinced that something had happened to him, but nothing had. He had just walked out on her.
What did she do?
She came back home and had a nervous breakdown, is what she did, Mr. Archer. Then she pulled herself together. She headed west and got work in L.A. as a writer.
A thought occurred to him, a critical one. But are you saying they never divorced?
I told her she should, but Eleanor refused. Maybe she thought he was going to come back to her, as if he ever would. He was a thorough scoundrel. I could see that from the first.
And she never had him declared dead?
Oh, I forgot that part. He left her a letter at his lodgings in Brazil. They kept the letter all that time and gave it to her when she arrived. I guess Nathaniel paid them to do it. He told her of his plans to vanish and start anew, so she had no grounds to declare him dead, because he wasn't. Makes my blood boil to this day.
Did he give a reason for wanting out?
If he did, she never shared it with me. I imagine he believed the grass would be greener somewhere else. Maybe he found some young señorita to tango with. As I said, over a decade older than Eleanor. He probably needed young women around him to boost his ego. A scoundrel through and through.
When was the last time you heard from your daughter?
She sent me a Christmas card and a check.
A check?
Yes, she sends me a check every month, and the amounts have gone dramatically up over the last 18 months or so. She explained that she had gotten a huge raise. I suppose writers in Hollywood make a great deal of money, and it is certainly very welcome to me. Mr. Lamb served his country honorably, but he never made much money.
Would you mind telling me how much she sends you each month now?
I suppose it doesn't matter. $1,000, just like clockwork.
So $12,000 a year?
Yes. As I said, she's done very well out there.
Yes, she has. Better than most, in fact. When was the last time you spoke with her on the phone?
Oh, about 2 weeks ago.
She seemed okay?
Oh, yes, fine. Now, will you please tell me what's going on out there?
I would if I knew. But I promise as soon as I find out anything, I will let you know.
Have I told you anything helpful?
You can't even begin to imagine how helpful you've been. Archer hung up the phone and leaned back against the wall. He took the picture out of his pocket and looked down at it. An older Nathaniel Summers stared back at him. So Eleanor Lamb and Peter Bonham were married. And apparently, still are. Chapter 66. Archer next called Jake Nichols and filled him in on all recent developments with Bender, his widow, and what he'd learned from Alice Jacoby about the Jade. Nichols also had some information for him.
Peter Bonham is in the import business. On the surface, it's antiquities from South America and Mexico and Guatemala, places like that.
And underneath the surface, dope, added Archer. Nichols said,
his company is private, so there's no dollar amounts I could find. But he has no deadbeat debts hanging out there, and his home alone is worth a small fortune and has no mortgage. He has accounts at about a dozen different banks. He's also got interest in a string of hotels and restaurants around L.A., and he has his fingers in local card clubs, and even has a small stake in Hollywood Park Racetrack. So that's how he cleans his dirty dope money. The business address listed is his home in Malibu, where I guess he maintains an office. He also has a big warehouse near the airport, probably where his legit business is run out of.
But you didn't look in his backyard. He has a bomb shelter. That's where he keeps the dope, and the people he's selling.
A bomb shelter, huh? Okay, first time for everything. Funny thing was, I couldn't dig up anything on the guy past 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think I know why. Archer filled him in on what Margaret Lamb had told him about Bonham's past.
So Lamb and Bonham, sitting in a tree, all those years ago?
He was the friend she moved to Malibu to be closer to. I thought it was Bernadette, but it was Peter Bonham. Bernadette and Lamb also knew each other back east. My hunch is Bonham might have met Bernadette back then, too, while he was courting Lamb. Bernadette told me her father and Lamb's father were both diplomats. The families were friends, and that she and Lamb went to school together as young girls. But they met up again in Washington after college. Bonham married Lamb in France, and years later he did the same with Bernadette. He ditched Lamb, changed his name, and put together a new identity.
You think Lamb was blackmailing him? I mean, she's got the goods. He's a bigamist. You can go to jail for that. Not to mention being quite the bad surprise for his current wife.
Archer said, that actually makes sense. Bernadette knew he was married before, but she said the first wife died. At least that's what Bonham probably told her. And then Bernadette might have introduced Peter to her old flame Paley. And with Peter's overseas connections and Paley's mob ties in this country, a match was made in hell for selling people and dope.
But then Bart Green and Peter Bonham start playing footsie and cutting Paley out of some of his shipment and transporting it in Green's beechcraft. How do you figure that happened?
Asked Nichols. I don't know. But it did. Bonham really had to walk a fine line there. I mean, if his wife was chummy with Paley, he had to keep her in the dark about all of this, or else she'd run to Paley and spill the beans.
And then Peter Bonham gets dumped in the Pacific, said Nichols.
And I'm betting Lamb stumbled onto this arrangement sometime before she moved to Malibu. Her mother told me Lamb started sending her a grand a month about 18 months ago, so that timeline fits. Nichols let out a sharp whistle.
12 grand a year to her mother. Makes you wonder what Eleanor Lamb is pulling in from Bonham to keep her mouth shut.
And that would explain what they were arguing about at that party. She was probably demanding more money. And then Bonham gets tired of paying, a body ends up in Lamb's house, and she goes on the run. Archer stared off for a moment. Although I did find something down in Anaheim that points a finger in another direction.
What was that?
Bender had no files on his work for Mallory Green.
Maybe someone stole them. He said the safe had been broken into.
Yeah, but why would they take that stuff? And there was no Wheeldex card for Green either. And Mallory had already volunteered to me that she had hired him previously. So why would someone want to try and hide a fact that the lady freely admits is true? And his calendar was taken too. Why?
You're right. Something doesn't add up. You have a theory?
I don't think there was ever a Wheeldex card or a file on Mallory Green because Bender never worked for her. I think she was lying about the whole thing.
Come again?
I think Green staged the robbery at Bender's to make it look like someone had cleaned out any record of her having hired Bender. But there wasn't any record, because she didn't hire him to investigate her husband's allegedly adulterous behavior. Not before, and not now. So if I went there and found no record of that, I'd come back to her with a lot of questions. So she had to take action. The robbery was how she covered her tracks.
But Archer, what possible reason would she have to lie about hiring a PI?
It could be she's covering for her husband. If he's mixed up in smuggling dope with Bonham, she may be trying to protect him. See, that money is the only thing keeping Bart Green safe from the mob. And while it's clear Mallory Green does not love her husband anymore, she told me that she needs old Bart around, or her career goes kaput. So they might be working this thing together.
So she didn't hire Bender. Who did? Because Bender was clearly investigating something that ended up getting him killed.
I found a Wheeldex with a curious name on it, a company called PID. And I discovered from looking at his bank records that Bender had gotten several large payments from PID. Large enough for him to pay off his mortgage of 5 grand.
PID? Did that ring a bell with you?
Maybe. But I needed confirmation, so I phoned the number on the Wheeldex card. Can you guess whose number it is?
Tell me.
The Jade Lion.
The Jade? But where does PID come in?
What's Paley's middle name? Do you know?
I know everything about the guy. It's Isaac.
So his initials are D.I.P. Now flip that around.
Damn. D.I.P. becomes PID. So he hired Bender. But why?
Bender must have known Paley was bad news, but he was hard up for money. So he was a good guy who made a deal with the devil. And Paley paid way above the going rate. So Bender's widow is going to be okay.
But what did Paley hire him to do, Archer?
Bender was hired by Paley to find out who was drinking out of his dope trough. And Bender found out it was Bonham, selling to Green.
Okay. I see where this is going, all right, said Nichols.
Archer continued. If Bonham learned that Bender was investigating him and might finger him to Paley, it would be a motive for Bonham to kill the guy. Bender was beaten up pretty badly. They probably worked him over to make him talk. And then Bonham kills him and dumps the body in Lamb's house, not only to throw suspicion off him, but also to scare the blackmailing Lamb into going on the run and getting off his back.
Rings true to me, Archer. Nice bit of deduction.
Yeah. Only now, I just have to prove it. Chapter 67. Archer left the idle hour and drove to the hospital to check on Morrison and Willie. The former was sitting like a statue in the same chair, her hand gripping one of Willie's. The latter was still unconscious, but now looking far more alive than dead. Archer called Callahan from the hospital and made arrangements to drive over and pick her up from the studio in Burbank and take her to where she was staying. She was waiting outside of Warner's, wearing a brown overcoat and clutching her purse with both hands. Archer had been to so many studios lately, he figured they should give him a SAG card. He opened the passenger door of the rental and motioned her in.
"This isn't the Delahaye,"
she remarked.
"Hell, what is?"
Callahan told him she was staying at an apartment in Brentwood rented by a friend of hers who had just gone away to shoot a movie in Mexico for Paramount. It was in a pink stucco building, nicely laid out with Spanish tile floors the color of sunset. Grainy, darkened wooden beams, plaster walls, and ceiling fans in every room, and a balcony with wrought iron railing overlooking a courtyard garden with a trickling fountain in the center. They'd picked up some dinner from a nearby deli and brought it to the apartment. Archer had driven a circuitous route and backtracked twice to make sure no one was following them. Callahan changed into white linen slacks and a light green long-sleeved blouse and put her hair up with a clip. She poured out some white wine, and they sat on the balcony and ate and listened to the strengthening wind and the fountain.
"So, Willie is really doing okay?"
she asked. "I talked to the doctors. He's out of danger. He's going to make it."
"Thank God."
"Thank the doc, and Willie being too stubborn to die." "Got a question," he said, taking a sip of the wine. "I found out from a banker guy that women can't get a loan for a house without a man signing too." Callahan set her wine down and glanced at him.
"That's right."
"So how did you manage it?" She took a bite of food.
"Somebody at Universal helped me. The studios, well, they understand the problem. Single actresses make enough money to buy a home but can't get a loan. So they have men who will guarantee the loan."
"Guarantee the loan? What do they get in return? You mean you have to pay them?" She glanced at him.
"Yes, they get a monthly fee. It's an added cost women have to pay."
Archer looked down. "I'm sorry, Liberty."
"For what?"
"That you have to go through crap like that. You make more than me, but I don't need you to co-sign a house loan."
"It's just the way things are, Archer."
"And that doesn't make them right."
"Forget it. I'm doing fine."
"How's the new film coming?" he asked after a few moments of silence.
"I play a frustrated housewife married to an American scientist secretly working for the Soviets. My part has some real meat to it. She turns out to be very heroic."
"That's great. What about that other film you were looking at doing? Dial M for Murder? You thought you had a shot at the lead?" She took a drink of wine and shook her head.
"I did a screen test, and I thought it went okay. But the thing is, I'm not a big star, Archer, and Hitchcock only works with the best. I heard they want Grace Kelly for the lead. She's all over town right now. Hell, she'll probably get the lead in Rear Window, too. But there are other roles in both films I can try for."
"Hey, it's still Hitchcock, right?" She mustered a smile.
"Yes, it is. So, how is the case coming?"
"It's coming maybe faster than before."
"And Darren Paley?"
"We're zeroing in on him, Liberty. Have no fear," she said sharply.
"But I do have fear, Archer. For you."
He put an arm around her shoulders and squeezed. "I know this one has been close."
"Close doesn't come close to describing it."
"After what happened to Willie, I can't walk away from it, Liberty. You know that." She finished her wine and poured them some more.
"I know it so well I can't sleep."
He dipped his head. I'm sorry.
It's not your problem. It's mine.
That doesn't seem fair.
Since when is life that? Sometimes you make your own bed, and sometimes you make somebody else's and have to sleep in it.
She looked around, and her expression lightened.
Sherry, the gal that rents this place, was really keen to meet you, Archer.
Why was that? He said, looking surprised.
I showed her your picture. I can't imagine what she saw in it.
She added, in an impish tone.
Don't mess with my ego, Liberty. It's right where I like it.
She smiled.
Sherry knows Ellie, too. She was working on a picture with her before Ellie disappeared. I told her what happened. She's really upset about it, too.
Is that right?
Yes.
She glanced at him with a mischievous look.
I also told Sherry about our date at Chasen's. She joked that she was going to crash it so she could meet, as she said, the world's most handsome gumshoe.
This had a remarkable effect on Archer. He sat up straight, and his expression was tight and focused. You told your friend Sherry that I was a private detective, and that we were having dinner at Chasen's on New Year's Eve?
Yeah, why?
Do you think she could have told Lamb that?
Ellie? I don't see why. But so what if she did?
Lamb told us she was there that night for dinner, but her date didn't show up.
Right, so?
I know guys stand gals up, but on New Year's Eve? Where's he going to get another date? And she didn't seem all that upset, either. That always seemed off to me.
Yeah, you're right.
She lightly punched him in the arm.
I would have been steamed if you'd stiffed me, Archer.
But there'd be no reason for her to be upset if there was never any guy.
But then why would Ellie have been there?
To meet me. Callahan laughed.
Okay, I know Sherry said you were handsome and all, but don't let your ego...
She stopped and looked at him, understanding a lighting on her features.
You don't mean that. You mean it was because you're a detective.
Archer nodded. She was probably waiting for you or me to mention my profession, and if neither one of us did, she'd figure a way to work it in somehow. And then she lays her whole story out for me, says she wants to hire me, and I go out there and trip over a dead body.
But she couldn't possibly have known you'd go out there that night.
She didn't have to. It was enough that she told me she feared for her life. That would explain why she disappeared, and I'd run around making inquiries after she didn't show for our meeting to give her vanishing legitimacy. He looked at her. I would be the reason people would think she was missing, because someone had done something to her. Otherwise, they'd think she'd just run off on her own, and people would look for a reason why she would do that, and that would not be good for her.
But she had no idea then that a dead body would show up in her house.
Bender had been dead since around 2 that afternoon.
Wait a minute. Are you saying she came to Chasen's to meet you knowing that there was a dead body in her house?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Do you think she killed him?
I don't know. I do know if she did, she couldn't have moved him from where he was killed to where he was found, not by herself.
But why put somebody you killed in your own house? Why not dump him in the ocean?
It might not have gone down that way. I have another theory, but that's all it is.
So was someone trying to kill Ellie? Or was that all just a lie, too?
I haven't figured that part out.
What the hell is going on, Archer?
I don't know all the pieces, just some. But the more pieces I find, the more the picture comes alive. And by the way, Lamb is married. Callahan's jaw slumped.
What?
He explained about Lamb and Peter Bonham, and also that Lamb had blackmailed Gloria Mars, and that the woman had also worked with Alice Jacoby in infiltrating the Jade for research on a script that they wanted Samantha Lourdes to star in and Ransom to direct. They knew about the dope, and maybe the other stuff, and they never told the cops. And I can bet you that Lamb would have blackmailed Lourdes into starring in it. She threatened to expose her dirty little secret at the Jade if she didn't go along. Callahan looked gobsmacked.
You think you know somebody. What a thorough bitch.
Nobody in this town really knows anybody else. I know that, and I don't even live here. I just trespass from time to time.
I guess you're right,
she said glumly.
Do you think they'll ever get the movie made?
He looked upset by the query. Who cares? I only care about the real part of this whole thing, Liberty. I'm not into fantasies.
I can see that now, Archer. I really can.
She said this in a voice so despondent, and her expression was so forlorn, that he took her hand and held it. And they listened to the wind and the fountain until it grew quite dark, and Archer had to take his leave. It was time to go back to Malibu. Chapter 68. Archer sat in the Oldsmobile and stared at the Bonhams' place. It was midnight, and there was a light on. Danforth's house was dark, the same for lamps. But the light on at the Bonhams' was like a heat lamp for Archer. It might lead him where he needed to go. The wind picked up, and a quilt of clouds covered up the dull glow of moonlight. Earlier he had retrieved the developed photos he'd taken at the Bonhams' house. The glossies were clear and looked good, and were probably enough evidence to send the man away for life. He put them back in their folder and kept surveying the house. Archer stiffened as he saw movement in the breezeway. Then a light came on in the garage. Next he saw the garage door being lifted up. There was Bernadette Bonham, doing the honors. Outlined in the glow, she looked like she was on a movie set, getting ready for her big number under a hot spotlight. Then a car started up. She moved out of the way as the Bentley backed out. She turned off the light and closed the garage door. She got into the car and pulled it off down the road. As it passed by Archer, he couldn't see who was driving, but he had a pretty good idea. He waited until the car was out of sight, then he headed across the street and into the backyard. He reached the entrance to the bomb shelter and pulled out two items from his trench coat, bolt cutters and a flashlight. He snipped the padlock with the cutters, tossed it away, and lifted the hatch. He grabbed his flashlight, looked around, and started his descent. The steps were metal, and the entrance hatch was the most elevated part of the shelter. When he reached the bottom step, he figured the shelter was about 6 feet underground with the dirt and grass covering it. He didn't think that would save you from an H-bomb blast, but he wasn't a scientist, just a Seamus. He shone his light around just about the time the stench hit him. It was so overpowering he almost gagged. He covered his nose and mouth with the fabric of his coat and stood there looking where the light was shining. Cheap sleeping bags were on the floor that was covered with trash and filthy clothes. There was a bucket used as a toilet. Half-eaten food and empty cigarette packs were lying around everywhere. There was a glass jug of dirty water. Benches were built into the walls, and there were grimy blankets and sheets piled there. They figured it would get pretty damn cold down here. There must be air vents and filtration somewhere so people wouldn't suffocate, but he knew it wouldn't be easy to breathe the foul atmosphere down here even with those devices. He walked around and shone his light on the metal walls. He stopped when he saw the words that people had etched into the painted metal, maybe with fingernails, maybe with something else. Ayúdame. Peligro. Muerte. Archer knew enough Spanish to translate those words into help me. Danger. Death. And then there were other things marked into the walls, but they were from another alphabet. Maybe Chinese or Japanese, he thought. Despite the language difference, he believed these messages said pretty much the same thing. Help me. But no one had. And the Bonhams had a nice big house and drove a Bentley. Sometimes Archer just wanted to shoot life right in the face. He'd been standing right above here with the gardener. Why hadn't he heard anyone? Why hadn't they cried out or pounded on the door above? Then he saw the pile of chains under one bench and the large bolt inserted into the walls where those chains would go through, and he discovered a large bottle marked chloroform, along with a canvas bag filled with cloths formed into gags for the mouth. That was why the folks down here had remained silent, and also why they'd been stumbling the night Archer had seen them emerging from here. They must have been drugged during the day. At night, there'd be no one close enough to hear them. He kept moving around until he reached the very back of the shelter. A bundle of blankets was on one of the benches. He moved closer and shone his light over it. He grabbed an edge of one blanket and pulled it away, and he did the same with another layer. Then he drew back. Revealed was a pale hand, the veins underlying the skin waxy and still. He knelt down and pulled away more coverings until a face was revealed. It was a mask of white, and like the hand, very much dead. Well, somebody else had been driving the Bentley. Because Peter Bonham was right here, in his own little chamber of horrors. Archer pulled more of the blankets off him until the man's fully clothed body was revealed. He had on a nice suit. The tie was blue, the shirt was white, and red. Where the knife blade had gone in. Right into the heart, was Archer's estimation. The hand wielding the blade knew just where to strike. Bonham's death would have been pretty much immediate. A stopped heart halted everything else fast. And Bernadette had gone off with her husband's killer, Archer assumed. Of her own free will. Hell, she'd even gotten the garage door for the man. And it was a man, Archer knew. The knife wound was in the front. Bonham was a big, strong guy. Archer knew this. He'd fought the man on the beach. His wife hadn't taken him like this. Archer knew one guy who could have. And he had the scars to prove it. He made his way out and over to the door into the house off the breezeway. He turned the knob and found it unlocked. He made a quick search and found that Bernadette's closet had been largely emptied, as was a jewel case he found in a drawer. He knew she had a valid passport because of the trip to France. Were they making for L.A. International right now? He used the phone to call the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and asked for Phil Oldham. Fortunately, he was on duty tonight. When he got on the phone, Archer told him about finding the body.
Jesus! Was how Oldham broke the silence.
Jesus isn't going to help Peter Bonham. And I don't care if you got pulled from the Bender case. You need to put out in all points for the airport, train station, and bus depots, shipping ports, and all the highways. It's Bernadette Bonham and Darren Paley you're looking for. He gave Oldham a description of them, the Bentley and the license plate. I found out that they knew each other back in Reno. My take is that Paley hired Bender to find out if Bonham was cheating him on the dope supply spigot. Bender apparently did his job, only Bonham found out what he was up to and killed him. Paley then took his revenge on Bonham. Bonham's wife showed her loyalties lay with Paley and not her dead hubby. Now they're on the run together.
Okay, I'll take care of all that. To hell with my pension.
You know Jake Nichols?
Yeah, he was a damn good PI. Real bad what happened to him.
He's the reason Willie got on board this case. Jake and Willie are tight. And that SOB Darren Paley is really the guy who put Jake in that wheelchair.
That? I didn't know.
And Paley was the reason Willie almost died. So I want the guy real bad, Phil. Real bad.
Okay, Archer. I hear you loud and clear. I can be there in about 30 minutes. You sit tight.
No, Phil, I can't. I've got something else to check.
Archer, if you...
Now listen closely. On Bonham's desk in his study, I'm leaving a folder with pictures showing Bonham with the crates of dope and the hooded prisoners. Along with that is a lab report that analyzed some white powder I found in Bonham's backyard. Turns out it was heroin. They probably dropped some of this stuff when they were bringing it in from the beach. Situated in the middle of the rear lawn is the bomb shelter. I left the hatch up so you can't miss it. You'll find more evidence down there along with Bonham's body. And another thing. You need to do a raid on the Jade Lion in Chinatown.
That's not my jurisdiction, Archer.
Which is why you need to get on the horn to LAPD. Somebody you trust in narcotics and vice, and work with them. If the LA cops want some good ink in the dailies, this will do wonders. That truck was heading to the Jade. They sell dope out of there, along with a lot of other rotten stuff that you boys in blue need to stop.
I can't organize a raid tonight.
And do it tomorrow night. But just do it. You'll get a promotion, and you can buy a new car and take the wife to Chasen's all by yourself. He hung up before the detective could fire off another response. Archer was in the Olds and down the canyon road in under 3 minutes. He knew if he passed any prowlers, they'd be looking for his Delahaye, not the dumpy Oldsmobile. Oldham would have assuredly told them that. Sure enough, 10 minutes later, two county radio squad cars shot past him without even a look at the Olds as they headed to Las Flores. Archer drove straight to the airport in L.A. and was lucky enough to get a plane reservation that would deposit him in Reno around 5 in the morning. He made a call from an airport payphone to Jake Nichols, who was fully awake, and told him about the latest developments. Then he filled the man in on exactly where he was going and why. He next called and woke up PI Jim Swinson in Reno and told him the same, and that he had booked a flight. Can you meet me at the airport?
I'll be there, said Swinson.
What's the word from your guy on the ground?
There's activity, Archer. I'll fill you in when you get here.
Archer made one more call to a number that a certain someone had given him. That certain someone answered in a sleepy voice.
Hello?
Sam?
Who is this?
Asked Samantha Lourdes. Archer.
Archer? Do you have any idea what time it is?
He could envision her sitting up in bed, in a lacy sheer negligee maybe, and being all indignant. For some reason that made him smile. And he needed to smile right now, or else he might pull his .38 and start shooting people. Yeah, actually I do. I'm feeling every minute of it.
What do you want?
Don't go back to the Jade.
Did you really call to lecture me in the middle of the night about that?
She snapped at him.
Of all the crazy things.
I'm not generalizing, Sam. I'm being real specific. The cops are going to raid the Jade probably tomorrow night, just in case you were thinking of going. I wanted to warn you to stay away. She didn't say anything for a few moments.
I actually was going tomorrow night.
Then you can stay home and read a detective novel instead of getting booked by LAPD for real.
What's happened, Archer? Tell me.
That gal you pointed out in the photo?
The one who hooked up with Darren while we were married?
Yeah. She and Paley just murdered her husband in Malibu, and are right now legging it out of here.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I hear his name a lot lately, only he doesn't seem to be showing up to do his job anymore. So don't go back to the Jade, ever, okay? Paley has too much going on to worry about you anymore. You are off his gravy train, Sam.
All right, I promise I won't. And thank you for the heads up. What are you going to do now?
What I always try and do. Catch the bad people.
Why is that so important to you, Archer?
She said breathlessly. It made his skin tingle all the way across the ether. He imagined her giving him the Samantha Lourdes classic movie look. That image actually calmed him. I guess it's just in my nature. Chapter 69. The flight took off into a cloudy sky, but when they broke through the heavy cover, there was the moon looking bold and bright. But Archer wasn't impressed with the moon even a little. He spent the flight staring out the window at a sea of clouds below and a sky that had no defined horizon, much like his thoughts. The clouds looked like ocean breakers frozen in mid-arc, which was unnatural and thus unnerving. The sky looked unfamiliar and unsettling, but he could not look away. Their final approach into Reno was extremely turbulent because of low-level crosswinds, but Archer barely noticed, even as a baby wailed, and the young woman sitting next to him threw up into a little paper bag helpfully provided by the airline with its logo on it. They landed, and Archer was the first one off the plane. In the small terminal, Jim Swinson waved at him. Swinson was in his late 40s, about 5'11", lean and tightly built with a swell of brown hair frosted at the sides and a trim mustache of a similar color combination. He had on a dark suit, no tie, and a snap-brim hat with a checkered band held in one hand along with a poker face. "You got a gun?" Archer asked.
"I got a pocket, I got a gun."
"Good, because right now we can't have too many guns." They walked out to Swinson's car. It was a Ford, as trim and lean as its owner. Dawn was still far from breaking, but the darkness was a shade lighter than the one Archer had left back in L.A.
"So Paley is on the run with Bonham's wife, and her hubby's dead?"
"Yeah, the county cops are on it, but Paley is an old hand at this. He could slip through easily enough. The guy's a planner, and he must have planned for this eventuality."
"But once he offed his supplier, what did he think he was going to do?"
"Who knows? But there are possibilities. Maybe he was cutting out the middleman. Then he could deal direct with the suppliers."
"But he has a dead body to contend with."
"But he probably figured no one would find the body in the bomb shelter for a long time, if ever. And if the cops figured out Bonham was selling dope, the murder could be blamed on any number of people, most likely in Mexico. Bonham stiffed them on a payment, that sort of thing. You play dirty, you end up dirty. And dead."
"And Mrs. Bonham? Wouldn't the cops have wondered what happened to her when they found her husband's body?"
"That's Mrs. Bonham's problem." Archer lit up a lucky because he really needed to. He let the stiff breeze carry the spent match away. "And she may not know it, but she's a French princess who just turned back into a frog, and a scorpion just hitched a ride on her slimy back." Swinson narrowed his already narrow eyes.
"What frog?"
"Never mind. Tell me about the activity. As they drove out of the airport, Swinson said, A truck came in a few hours after you phoned about Willie. It was unloaded and a bunch of crates were brought into the house. Then about 3 hours later, some other people showed up with another truck. And let me guess, the crates went right back out? That's the gist of it. My guy got photos of everything. You there now? Swinson nodded. Then let's join him. The drive took about an hour as they headed due south and passed through Carson City. The skies were light, but official sunrise was still an hour away by the time they arrived at the surveillance spot Swinson's man had set up. The temperature was in the 30s, and getting colder even as the skies lightened. Archer thought he saw a stray flake or two. The fat clouds were like a vast fleet of planes ready to open their belly doors and carpet-bomb Tahoe into snowy submission. Swinson's associate was introduced to Archer as Duncan Reed. He was about 5 years older than Archer, 6 feet tall, his solid build covered by a cheap brown suit and a dull green tie with a frayed shirt collar pinching the tie's knot. His eyes were alert, though the grind of his watch was telling in his face and skin. Stakeouts sapped you, Archer knew, without your moving a muscle. Give Archer a look at the place, Reed. The man stifled a yawn.
Okay, they're probably still asleep.
He led them over to a break in the bushes and handed Archer a pair of expensive binoculars. Archer used them to look down on a large chalet situated on private grounds right on the shore of Lake Tahoe. The home was an alchemy of redwood and cedar and large boulders and enormous metal-framed windows. It had odd angles and massive cantilever beams along with metal supports to reinforce where jutted out at the top, like the bow of a ship, to take full advantage of the views. It was as though the upper section of the house was actually over the water instead of just the adjacent sandy beach. It was a niftily done optical illusion, and no doubt cost a fortune. And now Archer knew from where that fortune had come. Who have you seen come and go besides the truck? He asked.
Lady in an old Packard. She drove out after the truck left, and then back about an hour later. She hasn't left since.
Describe her. Reed did so.
No one else? You sure?
Swinson answered.
He's sure. See, we two-manned this thing. Have a guy down the road watching all traffic. We passed him but didn't see him, but he saw us for sure.
Reed pulled a small device from his pocket.
And I'm hooked up to him via walkie-talkie.
Makes sense. She had to be here to receive the shipment and then send it on.
Who are we talking about, Archer?
Asked Swinson.
Mallory Green.
I thought it was her husband who was doing the drug dealing.
So did I. But now I think I was wrong. He's not smart enough to pull this off, and his balls aren't big enough. I just wonder why she left the house when she did. And no one was with her when she came back?
Nope. Not that I could see, replied Reed.
You got a spare walkie-talkie?
Swinson got one and set it to the right frequency.
What are you going to do?
You guys sit tight. I'm going to pay Mrs. Green an early morning visit.
Chapter 70. Archer always liked to approach a problem from the rear. He had learned in the war that frontal assaults made generals look heroic, but made their soldiers simply dead. About halfway to his destination, he halted and took in the lay of the land. The snow-capped Sierra Nevadas were marshaled on the shore across the breadth of the wide lake. They stared back at him like a vastly arrayed army, just waiting for the order to charge the waters. He continued on, finally broke free of the tree line, and came out on the beach, and immediately felt the wind gusts pummel him through his overcoat. Sand propelled by the wind nipped at him, and he turned away from the stinging grit. A long wooden deck stretched from the house out to the water. There was a weather-beaten dock at the end of it with a wooden boat on a lift, its top covered for the winter season, with only a bit of its varnished underbelly exposed. He eyed the rear deck, set in stone pavers, where some covered outdoor patio furniture sat. Cut into one wing of the house was an arched stone tunnel that led to the front of the house. That was an unusual feature, thought Archer, but it did give access to the beach and water without going through the house. He ducked inside the tunnel and spied a yellow pre-war Packard convertible with white walls and a top in the up position parked there. It was in superb condition, and must have cost a mint new, thought Archer. And this had to be the car that had been seen coming and going from the house. He opened the passenger door and peered inside. The interior smelled of old, cracked leather and cigar smoke. He looked at the registration tag on the steering post. Mallory Green, That was who Reed had seen driving it. He closed the door softly and crept to the rear. He lifted the trunk hatch, expecting to find a spare tire and some tools. He stood there for a few moments, gazing down at it. The it had once been a person. He reached down and touched the man's jaw. It was cold. He lifted one of his arms. It was not difficult to bend. By the look of the body, the man had already passed through rigor mortis. That meant he'd been dead a while, thought Archer. Maybe since Green had driven back that day. Steve Everett, the now former pilot, was dressed in clothes similar to those he'd been wearing when he'd flown Archer to Vegas. Archer looked for the wound that had ended the man's life, and finally found it under the right arm. A small bullet entry hole in the side of the chest wall. And the bullet was still in there, because Archer could not find any place where the slug had come out. The wound was so insignificant that on the surface it seemed doubtful it could have ended a life. But small things often could. A tiny tumor grown large. A minuscule virus expanding out of control in one's lungs. Or possibly, a .32 caliber aimed just right. He thought about possible killers and motivations. They seemed relatively straightforward. The only unknowable right now was how the body had gotten here. He said goodbye to Everett and closed the trunk. Archer noted a door halfway down the tunnel and tried to turn the handle. Of course, it was locked. Instead of his knife, because the lock looked substantial, he took out his felonious toolkit. A minute later, the door was no longer an obstacle. He slipped through and closed it behind him. He found himself in a hallway with a set of steps heading up at the far end. The floor tiles were blue and white, and designed such that they gave the impression of one walking on water. Jesus, he said, with more than a hint of irony. He walked across the watery tiles and up the steps to dry land. He checked his watch. It was not yet 7. He should have been exhausted, yet he had never felt more awake in his life. If I survive this, I swear to God I'm sleeping for a week. The place was cavernous and chilly, like a real cave would be. The hall he was on was long and as straight as a knife blade. His ears hummed as he listened for any sound, and he was rewarded and also disappointed when he heard none. He left the hall and entered a soaring 2-story great room with a vaulted ceiling filled with beams and tongue-and-groove woodwork. The rear-facing windows were nearly as tall as the room and gave breathtaking views of the lake. Another wall held a stone fireplace. Its metal doors were open, and a fire, probably from last night, was doing its last bit of dying out. Archer could still feel the warmth from the embers, which sharply contrasted with the frigid snow-capped peaks that filled the windows. The furniture was large and looked handmade. Not a stick of middle-income department store furniture in this place, thought Archer. He made a quick search of the rooms down here, which wasn't easy, because the interior was a labyrinth. The kitchen was large and modern, and laid out with elegance and functionality. A set of windows looked out onto the lake from a small breakfast nook, with built-in banquette seating upholstered in cobalt blue. Every room was optimally furnished, not too much, not too little. And Green had